This is Rabbi Josh Yoder of the Stanton Street Shul. Thank you for downloading this class podcast. These classes are provided free of charge through the generosity of the Stanton Street Shul community and supporters like you. If you do enjoy them, please consider making a donation to our synagogue's building fund on our website's shop donate page at www.stantonstshul.com.
Good morning, everyone. It is Sunday, February 23rd, 2014. Already starting to feel like spring. A little weird. Thank you all for coming out. We're about to start Chapter 8 of Rambam's Laws of Shabbat. Last week, we introduced the actual 39 Melachot. To give you a brief preview of what we're going to do for the next couple of weeks, for the next bunch of chapters, Maimonides does very quick, almost like a hit-and-run treatment of a lot of these 39 categories. He does not deal with them in equal proportion. After, you know, he goes through a bunch of these for, I don't know, maybe four and a half chapters or so, he spends multiple chapters just dealing with the details of carrying. We may not do all of those, and then he goes back to other things too. So for right now, expect just a lot of rapid fire treatment regarding some of the major categories of labor. Something which we might deal with on a case-by-case basis is modern-day applications. So just as a reminder, last week, one of the ways that, you know, we saw that the 39 melachot, there were these 39 categories, and we saw conceptually some of them could be lumped together as one unit. For example, we saw a bunch that seemed to be part of the bread-making process. All the way from the very beginning of how do you go about growing flour. Not growing flour, no one grows flour. Well, you do grow flour, but different type of flour. That was an unintentional pun. Growing, you know, wheat, you know, planting a seed, and, you know, preparing stuff for, you know, planting, all the way to, you know, baking the hot, like the bread. So all of those can go together, but, I mean, let's face it, most of us today don't live in agrarian societies. You've got a bunch that we dealt with regarding creating leather garments, which started with trapping throughout the whole process there. You know, trapping, killing, skinning, all that stuff, right? Measuring. Some of those are going to have more relevant analogs to modern practice than others. All right, so we'll deal with that on a case-by-case basis. If you pick up one of those books that I mentioned all the way at the beginning, also at the YU's farm sale that's still going on, like that big children's book they probably have called the 39 Avot Melachot, they'll actually give you, like, oh, here are some things that, you know, you can't do, or like something that it means with that that might make it a little more practical to people. All right, so let's start off with Chapter 8.
A person who plows even the slightest amount of earth is liable. One who weeds around the roots of trees, cuts off grasses, or prunes shoots to beautify the land, these are derivatives of plowing. One is liable for performing even the slightest amount of these activities. Similarly, one who levels the surface of a field, one who lowers a mound and flattens it or fills a valve, is liable for performing a derivative of plowing. One is liable for performing the slightest amount of these activities.
All right. So the one thing that's important to consider here that he does, Rambam's going to do for all of these, is he's going to give you the shi'ur. He's going to give you the amount. Something that, you know, we spoke about at the very beginning. In order to violate Shabbat biblically, for any action, you need to say, well, what constitutes having completed that action? There are certain things where if you do an action but do it less than the biblically prescribed amount, you would violate Shabbat only rabbinically. So here he says, even the smallest amount of this process means that you violate Shabbat biblically. Okay? So here, there's no gray area. Any little bit matters. Yeah, continue.
A person who sows even the slightest amount is liable. A person who prunes a tree so that it grows performs an activity resembling sowing. In contrast, watering plants and trees on the Sabbath considered merely a derivative of sowing. One is liable for even the slightest amount. Similarly, one who soaks the seeds of wheat, barley, and the like in water performs a derivative of sowing, and is liable for even the slightest amount.
Mm-hmm. Now, so 2 points to consider. One, read footnote 7. Footnote 7, in one of his responsa.
In one of his responsa, the Rambam explains that the source for his statements is Sivakim
94b.
94b, which mentions that one is liable for soaking seed, so they sprout.
All right, so stop there for a second. Here's a matter where intention can be important, right? When, you know, he's talking about soaking barley seeds. Okay? Now, you can soak barley seeds with the intent to grow them. Anyone who's done planting knows that. And anyone, actually, you guys might remember this, at least some of you, some of contemporaries in elementary school. You ever have that, like, little science project where you, like, first put these seeds in water and you watch them grow? And, like, you know, you put lima beans in and you see them, how they do, or you put stuff in them so that it sprouts?
Yeah.
No? So you did it. Okay. All right. So at least someone knows I'm not making this. There you go. Now, you can say it for something like barley, which we know from Rambam is a food substance. You can't really eat that raw. But maybe by soaking it, you can soften it up in order to eat that. Right? Here, the intent, I believe, matters. Meaning, if you want to eat barley and you want to soften it up, you know, yes, you might be, you know, soaking it in water, right? But it says, you know, again, in terms of the attention here, as he writes from Zavachim, right, you're liable for soaking seeds so they sprout, right? As opposed to soaking seeds so that you can actually eat them. You're not trying to grow them. You're not trying to actually facilitate any part of the growth process. And I don't know if this actually works with every barley. Has anyone actually done that with barley? I've never actually, at least not with our barley. Right? Because you could take this to any other, to logical extent. If you've got something that's, you know, like solid like beans, let's say you have dried beans and that's all that you got, you want to eat it on Shabbat by making it, you know, you're not going to cook it, but let's say you just want to soak it in water so that by the next day you can be able to eat it. I don't believe would be as part of this prohibition. Yeah.
Maybe not this prohibition, but you're changing its constitution.
We haven't gone there yet. One step at a time, right? We're only focusing here on the sprouting part. All right? And we'll get to your whole thing about changing constitution and to what degree. I know what you're referring to. That's going to come up not for a long while because that gets into questions of bone and stuff like that. We'll get to something like that. Okay. Also, I mean, how many here have plants? In their apartments or houses. Okay, so don't do stuff with them on Shabbos.
Okay.
All right.
Don't worry, don't do stuff with them.
You see, there you go. If anyone like wants to avoid problems, get a small little cactus, right, and just, you know, leave it there. Yeah. So if you do have plants on Shabbos, I mean, this is like the only relevant thing that can come to mind, right? Don't water your plants on Shabbos. Don't mess with the soil on Shabbos because that could be a prohibition, right? And remember what he said earlier about, you know, walking, you know, on, you know, how do you walk on the grass? You might remember that from the very first lectures because, you know, if it's a rainy day about causing grooves and all that sort of thing, refer back to the earlier classes there. Sam, number three.
One who reaps an amount the size of a dried fig is liable. Plucking fruit is considered a derivative of reaping. Similarly, any person who removes produce from where it is growing is liable for reaping. Therefore, a person who removes grass growing from a rock, a
parasite?
Something like that. Paris plant.
A parasite plant that grows on shrubs or grasses that grow on a barrel is liable, for this is the place where they grow. In contrast, the person who removes fruit from a plant growing in a flower pot that is not perforated is not liable, for this is not the ordinary place in which it grows. If, however, the flower pot has a hole the size of a small root, the plant is considered as growing in the ground, and the person who picks fruit from it is liable.
So this is it might seem like a strange law, but this is a recurring law in really the Talmud, the distinction of certain types of potted plants, whether or not a potted plant has holes on the bottom or the potted plant does not. If it's called an atzitz nakuv in Hebrew, if the potted plant has if the pot in which you put the plant has a hole in it, which many do today, by the way, then it is considered as if it is attached to the ground itself. If, however, it is a solid pot with no holes coming out of the bottom, then it's considered detached. You see Rambam here has, you know, halakhic implications for this scenario. There are halakhic implications for a bunch of other things, too. Right? But at least know that this isn't just Rambam, you know, arbitrarily making a brand new criteria here. This is a recurring theme within the Talmud. Dana number four.
Whenever reaping from a plant causes it to grow larger, e.g. cattle grass or beets, a person who harvests it without knowing of the prohibition involved is liable for two sin offerings, one because he performed the labor of reaping and one because he performed the labor of planting. Similarly, a person who prunes a tree and desires to use the branches he prunes is liable for reaping and planting.
All right, so stop for a second here. All right, remember I kept, you know, said before and even subsequent weeks, intent matters. Right? So in this particular case, it's possible with one action to violate two prohibitions if your intent is to use it for two different purposes. Right? Because here your intent is to prune a tree and you want to use it for, you know, something else. Right? Like in the process of pruning, right? Anyone know how you prune a tree? You like cut off a branch and then you attach another branch of a different, well, no, that's, whatchamacallit. No, that's not pruning. Pruning is just the simple cutting part, right? No, I got confused with the, splicing thing. That's also prohibited, but for other reasons. Anyway, so when you're just, right, if you perform if a person who prunes a tree and desires to use the branches he prunes is liable for both reaping and planting, even though all you've done really is cut off the, cut off the branch. Continue.
The following rules apply to clawed...
Grafting. That's it. I'm sorry. I knew it was going to come to me eventually, and it was either going to be 20 seconds later or, like, immediately after class. Grafting. Thank you. Continue.
The following rules apply to a clod of earth on which grass is growing. If one lifted it from the earth and placed it on staves, one's liable for uprooting. If it was supported by staves and one placed it on the earth, one is liable for planting. When figs have dried out while on the tree, and similarly other trees whose fruit have dried out, a person who picks them on the Sabbath is liable, although they are considered to be detached from the tree with regard to the laws of ritual purity.
Yeah, there are, okay. So, let's say you've got a dried fig. Like, there are, like, by dried fig, you don't grow dried figs. It's, you grow figs and they dry out on, you know, the vine, or not the vine, the tree. So, he's making an important distinction here between laws of Shabbat and laws of purity, right, in terms of Tumah and Tahara. Where, remember what I said earlier about the Atzitz Nakuv, the pot with holes in it? You have consistent rules down the road, you know, pretty much throughout Jewish law in terms of whether or not it's considered attached to the ground versus detached. When it comes to dried figs, there are different rules depending on what area of Jewish law you're talking about. So, for example, when it comes to, I mean, he describes it more in Hilchot Tumat Ochalin. You see the footnote here in footnote 16. So you can look up Hilchot Tumat Ochalin, chapter 2, Halachot 4 and 5, you know, to see the details there. But regarding Shabbat itself, we do not care if the figs are ripe or not ripe, or if they're overripe. The mere act of plucking it off the branch, regardless of its state, is prohibited. And if you want to try to think about conceptually why that might be, it, one, in terms of tumah, could be dependent on it being an edible food substance or a normally eaten food substance. Whereas the prohibition of plucking stuff off a tree is independent of what you happen to be plucking. Right? And we saw at the very beginning of Rambam, your intent matters, and like you have to be plucking the right thing that you're wanted to do. Remember that whole thing with the different colors of stuff that you're, you know, plucking out of the ground? Good time to do Chazarah. Chazarah, incidentally, when you use the term, means to review. So always, you know, go back to those first classes to, you know, go back over those laws. But let's say you've got a dried out fig. It doesn't matter that it's dried out. You're still plucking something off a branch. That's prohibited for Shabbat, even though when it comes to matters of Tumah and Tahara, it might not be considered as edible food, because you're talking about different laws for different subjects of Jewish law. just how things are. For one class of Jewish law, it's categorized as X. For another class of Jewish law, it's categorized as Y. It happens every now and again. You know, what?
Well, I mean, in various other places, this doesn't necessarily... The halakha doesn't... I mean, right now he's addressing stuff related to food.
Yes.
But, you know, the plucking and pruning and anything related to farming is still going to apply just the same for anything that's not food.
Yes.
So it seems consistent.
Well, in this regard, yes. It, again, compared to the laws of tumah and priority, no. Right? And you can argue it doesn't have to be. Right? But that gets into a much bigger question that, you know, will take us way too off topic. Mike, number five.
The following rules apply to one who uproots chicory or who prunes moist shoots.
Read footnote 17, because it explains, like, why this is important.
Although the latter are most frequently used as fodder for animals, at times they are cooked and eaten by human beings.
Okay. So continue.
If he intends to use them as food for human beings, the minimum measure for which one is held liable for reaping is the size of a dried fig. If he intends to use them as animal fodder, the minimum measure is the amount necessary to fill the mouth of a young kid.
Which seems to be slightly less.
If he intends to use them for kindling, the minimum measure is the amount necessary to cook an egg.
Right, and again, the footnote explains it, that it's that's considered the smallest amount that's considered useful for cooking. Okay?
Similar measures apply with regard to the forbidden labor of collecting food. If one's intent is to use it as food for human beings, the minimum measure for which one is held liable is the size of a dried fig. If one is intent for animal fodder, the minimum measure is the amount necessary to fill the mouth of a young kid. If one's intent is for kindling, the minimum measure is the amount necessary to cook an egg. Whenever the term an egg is used, the intent is an average-sized chicken egg. Whenever the term the amount necessary to cook an egg is used, the intent is the amount necessary to cook a portion of an egg the size of a dried fig. A dried fig is one-third the size of an egg.
Yeah, so, you know, you're laughing at this, but you should know the size of an egg is the subject of a long, long-standing argument in Jewish law, especially modern times, about what's the size of an egg. So to explain, you know, at least summarize a bit, a whole bunch of stuff that we can't get into detail here. Measurements matter. Right, and in Jewish law, you need a threshold to say, well, how much do you need in order to have completed an action? So for eating, this is comes up a lot, and it's going to come up a whole bunch in a month and 3 weeks when we get Pesach. How much matzah you eat is, you know, based on this sort of thing here. So what's considered an egg? You have in the footnote here, in contemporary measure, the size of an egg is determined as 57.6 cubic centimeters and 100 cubic centimeters by Chazon Ish. Right? What's the size of an egg? Are you talking chicken egg or ostrich egg? Anyone watch Top Chef? Every now and again, they bust out an ostrich egg. Someone thinks that they can cook with it. And it's like a massive bowling ball type thing. It's kind of weird. Anyway. Right? So what's considered the shiur? So, you know, he goes through here, and first thing to consider is, again, intent matters. But because intent matters in terms of what you're doing it for, you're going to have variable amounts that you need to do in order to violate the prohibition. Right? Because if your intent is to do one thing, well, the minimum threshold for that to be useful is going to be one metric. If you wanted to do something else, it could be greater, it could be less. All right? Now, that doesn't mean you should do any of this, mind you. It's a matter of, you know, he's laying out biblically, like, how do these rules... If you get, I guess, confused about what all these mean, consider it as he's trying to explain how do these rules work. Okay? And he's trying to delineate, depending on what your intention is, the exact same act can either be biblically forbidden or rabbinically forbidden if with the same amount. Now, how do you know what your intention is? Well, usually you have to say so, right? And remember, you know, what we said earlier, you know, all the way at the very beginning, in order to be chayav mitah, to be liable for the death penalty, you're going to have, you know, witnesses who say, here's exactly what, you know, don't do this, and explain, you know, what you're going to do wrong. You have to say, I know, and I'm doing this anyway. And then, you know, it's very hard to execute people in Jewish law. All right, so that aside, you know, we're not entirely sure. And the rest could be, well, whatchamacallit, you know, bringing your own sacrifice, if that wouldn't, you know, need. In terms of, let's say you're not sure how much you did, or you forgot what your real intention was, we'll let that question slide for the moment, right? But think about this less as a matter of consequences, or at least less in, well, that's a better way of putting it, less in terms of how are you going to get punished for it, as a, as an alternative, think about how does the Jewish law work? And in some cases, as we mentioned a few weeks ago, this is going to be important, because if you're stuck in an emergency situation, depending on what your intention is, this could be the difference between violating Shabbat rabbinically as opposed to biblically, such that in extenuating circumstances, you might be able to be mima'it bi'isur, to minimize whatever prohibitions you might be forced to do. I don't expect people to walk around on Shabbat with a ruler or some sort of tape measure to say, how much did I actually violate? Ironically, if you did so, you might have your own problems too, but we'll get that in several other chapters. All right? Yeah.
He's talking about the mouth of a young kid. He's talking about a goat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the context is feeding an animal. The amount that you could feed an animal, and it's the minimum criteria for minimum amount for feed. Obviously, larger animals, you'd have to feed more, right? So the trick is, what is the minimum threshold? Once you hit that minimum, you violate it biblically, right? So, yeah, you could say, well, I wanted to feed, I don't know, what's an animal that has a huge mouth and eats a lot?
Camel.
Cow or camel, there you go, right? Let's do cow, because I don't know what you feed a cow. So let's say it's a cow, right? So you might feed a cow a whole lot more than you feed a young kid. Why is that your thing? So it's not, right? How much have you violated Shabbat when you've done the minimum amount? That's what we're talking about here. Okay? We're not trying to say, oh, well, you wanted to feed that. It'll... Yeah. Let's leave it at that for now. But you could have other issues of like, well, I intended, you know, to feed a specific cow. It gets messy. Anyway, continue with six. That, I'm sure it is.
A person who collects figs and makes a chain from them, or one who pierces a hole through dates and passes a string through them until they are collected as a single entity, performs a derivative of the forbidden labor of collecting sheaves. The same applies in other similar circumstances.
So keep this in mind. No popcorn necklaces. That... Other issues like that, like, yeah, I don't know why someone would do this, but collecting sheaves, this could be a problem, you know, there too. Seven, a person who threshes, the language here is hadash kegegoret chayav. So Dana, this one's for you. Hadash asur mina Torah. Halacha 7? No, Law 7. I just made a really bad joke. None of you got it. You're all better off. Hadash Rasur Mina Torah. Okay, a person who threshes the amount the size of a dried fig is liable. The forbidden labor of threshing applies only with regard to earth's produce. Okay. Moving on. Extracting the produce from its shell is a derivative of threshing, and a person who performs this activity is liable. The same applies in all similar situations. Similarly, a person who milks an animal is liable for extracting food. By the same token, a person who wounds an animal that has a hide is liable for extracting, provided he requires the blood that flows from the wound. However, if his intent is merely to wound the animal, he is not liable, because his activity is destructive in nature. One is not liable unless one extracts the quantity of blood or milk the equivalent to the size of a dried fig. Yeah. So see footnote 29 here. The Rambam's opinion is also accepted by Rashi in Shabbat 95a and other authorities. Rabbeinu Tam and other Rishonim agree that milking is forbidden according to Torah law, but consider it a derivative of other categories of labor. Ramban considers this only a rabbinic prohibition. The Shulchan Aruch, which states that one may tell a Gentile to milk an animal. Note the Shulchan Aruch, which states that one may tell a Gentile to milk an animal. This leniency is permitted because the animal will suffer pain if it is not milk. Other leniencies are also granted on the basis of Rambam's statements in Halacha 10. And adds here, the question of milking animals attracted much attention in the early years of agricultural development in Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, when the question arose regarding milking herds of animals when a Gentile was not available. So remember what I said about an agrarian society? Well, when the land of Israel was starting, we kind of had to be an agrarian society. So this stuff comes up again. Yeah.
Two things. First of all, what's threshing?
Threshing. I'm trying to think of a good definition for threshing. Threshing is, how to describe that? One second, let me just... Okay, so please, Wikipedia entry for threshing.
Well, it's not Wikipedia, it's
good
enough. Separate the grain or seeds from a cereal plant or the like by some mechanical means, as by beating it with a flail or the action of threshing, or the action of a threshing machine. To beat as
a... That's a horrible definition. You're never supposed to use the term in its definition. So, what does threshing mean? Threshing means you use a threshing machine. Like, that's not helpful.
It's to separate the grain or seeds from a cereal or plant.
Thank you.
Okay.
Better?
Thank you.
All right. Yeah, I would not have been able to come up with something like that. I just know it's like, threshing, you've got the threshing floor. That's just what you do. All right. Anyway, continue Halacha 8.
When does the above apply? When one wounds an animal, a wild beast, a fowl, or the like, one wounds a fellow man, by contrast, one is liable, although one's intent is to injure, for this activity generates pleasure. It causes one's feelings to cool and one's anger to subside. Therefore, it is considered constructive in nature. Accordingly, even if one does not require the blood that one extracts, one is liable.
Yeah, this is a weird halacha here. fellow man, even if you want to injure someone, you see, remember what we said at the very beginning of, that in order for you to violate Shabbat biblically, it has to be a constructive act, right? That's why I made the distinction between if you want to just wound an animal, which is destructive, versus somehow you need the blood, which is constructive, right? But he makes an exception here regarding injuring someone, because even if you wanted to injure, because it's a destructive act, if your intent was to injure someone, you get pleasure when you do so. So there's a certain degree of Well, I don't know. I haven't gotten to a fight, or at least a fist fight, in a really, really long time. Anyway, moving along, Halacha 9.
The eight creeping animals mentioned in the Torah have hides whose status is analogous to those of animals, beasts, and fowl with regard to the Sabbath laws. Other small creatures and crawling animals are not considered to have a hide whose status is significant with regard to the Sabbath laws. Therefore, one who wounds them are not liable. One who wounds an animal, beast, fowl, or one of the above-mentioned eight creeping animals is liable, whether he caused an open wound from which they bled, or he made a bruise that caused internal bleeding.
Right. Is liable, whether he caused it with a bled or made a bruise that caused internal bleeding. Yeah. So don't, treat your pets nicely. Okay, this is also an interesting halacha. Sam, this one's, I think, a little bit more relevant to people today.
A person who squeezes fruit to extract its juice is liable for extracting. One is not liable until he extracts an amount of juice equivalent to the size of a dried fig. From the Torah itself, one is liable for pressing only grapes and olives.
So it explains here that the in footnote 40, Rashi in Shabbat 143b explains that the reason is that the primary purpose is that grapes and olives are grown for is these liquids. With regard to other fruits, by contrast, it is not as common to use them for juice. From his commentary to the Mishnah, it appears that Rambam also accepts this rationale. So he mentions here Right, meaning from the Torah, right, he calls us chayav mishum mifarek. There's one of the prohibitions of, the extracting thing, that en chayavim mina Torah, ela al drichat zeitim v'anavim bilvad, umutar l'schot eshkolim anavim l'tochoch. I mean, he makes a distinction here between olives and grapes, because their primary purpose back in the day was for squeezing. Meaning today, we eat apples, we also drink apple juice, right? What are they primarily used for? Well, the truth is it really depends probably these days on the orchard, right? But you eat, today also we eat, grapes too, and, eat olives. But in the time of the Rambam, at least, his understanding of the law is that grapes and olives were different because that was their main purpose. You didn't really have people eating olives as much as using the oil. You didn't have people eating grapes. It was done, but it was much more common to use them for wine. All right? Whereas for other types of fruits, yes, you obviously can extract juices, but it wasn't as considered to be their primary purpose. Continue.
It is, however, permitted to squeeze a cluster of grapes directly into food, since the liquid that is absorbed into food is considered as food. Thus, one is considered to be extracting food from food. Nevertheless, if one squeezes these liquids into a vessel that does not contain food, this is considered pressing, and one is liable. Similarly, one who milks directly into food, or one who sucks with his mouth, is not liable. One is liable only when one milks into a container.
With this, anyone here a Calvin and Hobbes fan? Bill Waters? No? Not a single person this year is a Calvin and Hobbes fan? Good Lord. Anyway, you should find this up online. I thought I'm using Calvin and Hobbes, where Calvin's having breakfast with Hobbes, and he says, I wonder, he was talking about, how this milk thing came. It's like, you know what? I wonder, who said, I'm just going to squeeze these things and drink the first thing that comes out of them. Hobbes says conversation should be limited for the rest of it. No one here knows Calvin and Hobbes? Oy. Anyway, now, you probably may have a bunch of questions on these, and as I said at the very beginning of this, the entire shiur, the more that you get into details, the more disputes you're going to have. The footnotes here include some of the later disputes with later commentators on Jewish law. People write, there are a whole bunch of ways that you can argue with it, and a whole bunch of ways you can argue with the application thereof. Okay, I don't want to get too much involved in that simply because you will never get past a disagreement. It's going to be perpetual. So when it comes time to specifics, we can handle that later and, check up other books and see how different things happen. At least according to Rambam, main takeaway here is the squeezing part is prohibited, provided it isn't done directly into food. If it's done directly into food, it's considered part of eating. Because by that logic, prohibited to do any sort of, squeezing in that regard, you'd never be allowed to eat an orange on Shabbat. Because the second that you press down on an orange, you're squeezing out the juice into your mouth. The second you press down on a grape, you're squeezing the stuff into your mouth. That's how it works. That's what eating is. Right? So, anyway. Yeah.
I have another question. Going back to Halacha 8.
Number 8.
The one about the fighting?
Sure.
Or injuring a human?
Yeah.
Basically, it seems like the argument is it's constructive because it's cathartic in nature.
Yeah.
Or some kind of, but doesn't that open up a big door? Like almost anything that's cathartic would then be considered constructive?
Not. It's an interesting point there. I'm not sure, honestly. To use your example of what's cathartic. So Maimonides said earlier that when it comes to burning is a destructive act. Like if I, want to torch a house, right? So if I torch a house, it's only biblically forbidden if I need to use the ashes, right? Because then it becomes a constructive act as opposed to a purely destructive act. Let's say I'm a pyromaniac. Or, alternatively, let's say I'm getting back at an ex, and I want to burn her house down, right? Now, that could be very cathartic. Anyone remembers the song, Sonny Came Home?
I remember that.
Thank you! Someone finally gets a reference here. Sonny came, right, well, it's about her burning down her house. That's the story, in the song. And something like that could be very cathartic. I honestly don't know whether or not that can apply to anything or specifically just, you know, beating up people. Yeah, it's an interesting question, and I'm not even sure how you would go about doing that. You know, like, if someone's to, like, yeah, I don't even know where to begin with that in terms of with that, you know. Oh, it's an interesting question. I wouldn't recommend trying to put that in practice, though. Anyway, number 11. We have two here. Yeah, go for it.
A person who winnows or separates an amount of food the size of a dried fig is liable. Causing milk to curdle is a derivative of the category of separating. Similarly, a person who separates the dregs from liquids is liable for having performed a derivative of separating or a derivative of sifting. The particular category of forbidden labor is not defined, because the labors of winnowing, separating, and sifting resemble each other.
Right, because you're... Remember, like, what all of these things have in common is you've got some combination entity or some entity that has a mixture of type A and type B, and you are somehow removing the connection between type A and type B.
Which threshing is also.
That's what he says here, right? Because all of this stuff, when we're separating and sifting, they all resemble each other. Yes, and to some degree, threshing might be too. Except with threshing, you might be able to say that it's like more of a formal attachment, whereas borer could be like separate. It's tricky.
Oh, this is borer. I didn't even look at the Hebrew.
Yeah, there you go.
Why were they reckoned as three separate categories? Because every labor that was performed in the sanctuary is counted as a separate category.
So functionally, you might not be able to think of the difference, like, well, is this considered threshing or is this considered separating? And so that gets a bit tricky here, right? And Rambam's saying, yeah, they're pretty much, you know, all the same action. It's just they're considered different because those were the different acts that were done in the Mishkan. Also, a nice little fun shtick that I did many, many years ago. Sifting in Hebrew is in merakeid, which also means...
to dance.
Yes. So at my Chavrusa Morty's wedding, I sifted flour, dressed up in a really odd costume, in order to fulfill the Gemara, Ketzad Miraktin Lifnei Hakala.
Nice.
Other people have apparently done that too. I did not come up with that myself, but there is somewhere online photographic evidence of me doing that. And all I can say is this, he got it. His wife looked at me like I was crazy. So, you know, in terms of being Mesamecha Tan Vekala, I got half of it. Anyway. And his wife was Israeli, mind you. So, like, if anyone else would have gotten it, would have been... So I think she kind of understood what I was doing, but Israelis and puns don't, you know, it's a different world.
Also, the contemporary Hebrew might not use Merakeid as...
At any rate, it's there. So number 12.
A person who separates food from unwanted matter, and one who separates one type of food from another food, using a sifter or a strainer, is liable. If one separates using a tray or a pot with compartments, one is not liable. It is permitted to separate food by hand to eat immediately.
Okay, and share with you 13, please.
A person who separates unwanted matter from food is liable, even if he does so using only one hand. A person who separates... thermos beans from their shucks is liable, for the shucks sweeten them when they are cooked together. Therefore, one is considered to be taking unwanted matter from food and is held liable.
Okay, continue.
A person who separates food from unwanted matter by hand and sets it aside to serve at a later time, even later on the Sabbath itself, is considered to have separated for the purpose of storage and is held liable. If there were two types of food mixed together before a person, he may separate one from the other and place it aside to eat immediately. If he separated one from the other and set it aside to serve at a later time, even later on the Sabbath itself, he is liable.
So, okay. Finish it off.
For example, one separated food in the morning to eat in the late afternoon.
Okay, so these, you know, this gets into something that, let me just do 14 and then we'll summarize a few things regarding borer. So a person who filters the dregs from wine, oil, water, or other liquids, using a utensil appropriate for this purpose, is liable, provided he removes the dregs for an amount of liquid equivalent to the size of a dried fig. One may, however, filter wine that has no dregs, or clear water with a handkerchief, or with an Egyptian basket, so that the water will become, so that will become crystal clear. He writes, in the others disagree on this, in terms of certain types of filters. We may pour water over the wine dregs, they will become clear. We may place a raw egg in mustard, strain, so that it becomes clear. When one has mixed mustard on Friday, one may stir it by hand with utensil to make it fit to drink on the Sabbath. Similarly, wine is in the process of fermentation. One may pour out a barrel of wine together with dregs over handkerchiefs. The dregs have not been finally separated from the wine, and they are still considered a single mixture. The same applies to mustard and all similar substances. So this question of borer comes up in a whole bunch of different categories in terms of what are types of things that you're allowed to select. The main rule is this. It's ochel mitoch psolet and psolet mitoch ochel. Ochel means food. Psolet are things that are inedible. Okay? Now, there are a whole bunch of other, let's go back over a few things about the exceptions here. Exception one, is if you're doing it by by hand to eat immediately, right? Which means you're not doing it with a strainer type thing, nor are you doing it with nor are you doing it to like save for later. Okay, so when you think about what does this sort of thing mean with separating.
Shelling
peanuts, pistachios, eating an orange, right? Those are things which if you're going to eat it immediately, sure. If you want to shell peanuts because you've got guests coming over later, I mean, I don't know what the criteria is for immediately, but yeah, that could be more problematic, all right? There are other issues that can come up with things with borer too, in terms of the utensil. Using, say, a slotted spoon, right? That's something which can come up a lot that people will attribute to borer. Like, let's say you're serving meatballs on Shabbos, okay? Many people serve meatballs with a slotted spoon, but to what extent does that slotted spoon actually drain? I mean, that could also depend on how mixture. Because sometimes when you take a slotted spoon of, like, meatball sauce, right, you're going to get a lot of sauce in there, too. So is that really considered separating? I will leave that up for people to debate. There is an application that people apply to borer that is well beyond anything that the Gemara, and certainly Rambam, would ever adhere to, and that is separation by things that are not food-based. There are some people who are strict to lay out their clothing before Shabbat. Because the assumption that if I, the mere selection of pulling out one suit as opposed to another suit is borer. That's not quite what the problem is. The problem seems to be focused specifically on matters pertaining to food, not to one object versus another object, right? And I also don't think it refers to things like people pass around chicken, right? Let's say you've got a tray of chicken. You want one piece of chicken as opposed to another piece of chicken. You're taking chicken, right? At some point, you can't get past like a certain selection thing. This is, certain types of, again, removal things. One place where this might come up for people would be getting rid of seeds in watermelons, right? If, let's say, you don't get the seedless watermelon and you want to try to peck out the seeds with a fork, right? Well, that could be more problematic in terms of borer because you're removing the psolet from the food. If you happen to eat the watermelon seeds, well, then it wouldn't really be psolet. So, anyway, yeah.
So, two things.
Yeah. Right, so that would be chicken from chicken.
Well,
I mean, every time you take a bite of food off a plate, you are separating food from food. No?
I was taught that if you serve peas and carrots, you can't separate the peas out from the carrots.
That's interesting. But at any point, that's still food again from food.
Yeah, exactly.
So if you can't separate peas from carrots, how would you ever be able to like take from a giant bowl of peas and carrots and put them on your plate? Are you not separating peas from peas and carrots from carrots?
No, you're taking some peas and carrots and you're creating a smaller portion of the same thing. You're just transporting them. You're not separating anything.
Yeah. I would say this. I'm sure someone would permit it, and I'm sure someone would prohibit it. That's the straight answer I can give you.
And the other thing is, So if you eat the watermelon with the seeds and then spit the seeds out without swallowing them,
seems to be okay, because that's in the process of eating it. Right, you're not using a utensil by it. I mean, unless you've got like really crazy braces, like the guy draws in James Bond. No one.
Moonraker.
Thank you. I need to start coming with footnotes here. Like, all righty. We're up to, so let's finish off the chapter. Right, now we're up to grinding of tochein.
A person who grinds an amount of grain the size of a dried fig is liable. One who crushes spices or herbs in a mortar is performing the labor of grinding and is held liable. A person who cuts a vegetable that has been detached from its source into small pieces performs a derivative of the labor of grinding. Similarly, a person who saws wood in order to benefit from the sawdust is similarly one who files a piece of metal is liable. For filing even the slightest amount. A person who chops wood is not liable for grinding until he produces enough chips to cook an amount of an egg the size of dried fig.
So this is something I'm not sure, you know, this is just, again, for the purposes of grinding, where you've got, like, a bigger entity and you want to, like, mush it around to make it, like, smaller. So that seems to be, like, problematic, right? As opposed to, you know, like, the cutting wood, again, right, if you're cutting wood specifically because you need the sawdust, right, then you're doing a creative act of trying to grind the wood down to its finer particles or whatever. Finishes off, Risa. Halacha 16.
A person who sifts an amount of flour the size of a dried fig is liable. A person who kneads dough the size of a dried fig is liable. Mixing earth for use as cement is a derivative of kneading. What is the minimum amount for which one is liable? The amount necessary to make a crucible for a goldsmith. The amount of mixing cement cannot be performed with ash, coarse sand, bran, or the lot.
Mm-hmm.
The person who places sesame seeds, flax seeds, or the like in mortar is liable for kneading because they become attached to each other.
Yeah, now check out the footnote here in 79. If a person places seeds into water so that they sprout, he's liable for performing a derivative of sowing. Right? If you pour, right, if one pours water over the seeds and mention this halacha, you're liable for kneading. I know this can get a bit confusing here. It's important to at least just get the general principles down so that when you hear, you know, stuff saying, well, this is a prohibition of this, you'll know kind of where it comes from, right? Many of these things are not going to be relevant to most people because, again, we don't deal with so much food-based stuff. Of what we've seen here, Boer is probably the thing that can come up more in terms of ways that you can wind up doing selection. We hear people, it's like, what do you mean I'm not allowed to strain water on Shabbat? How is that considered work? Well, here's your problem. I don't know anyone who sifts water on Shabbat, but you can understand why, you know, if someone has a colander and you've got, like, you know, let's say you had hard-boiled eggs before Shabbat and you didn't drain it, say, oh, I'll just, like, pour the whole, like, thing into the colander and I'll sit down and I'll be fine. No. Right? That would be a problem. Okay? And there are, again, like, other ways, you know, we don't want to get too much, you know, bogged down in the details. But know that these are considered, you know, prohibitions. They might be, again, related in some way in terms of separating one thing from something else. You'll just call it different things, depending on what it is that you're doing, but something to look out for. And again, check out some of the other books to see some other examples that we might not have discussed. That the reason why these are all prohibited is because these were all actions that were performed in the tabernacle as part of the service. So these are things that we don't do today, even though you might not even consider it as melacha, as labor by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, using a slotted spoon does not take a whole lot of effort, right? And that's an important consideration. It's not a matter of effort, it's a matter of what was the type of work that they did in the type of the Mishkan, and how is that applicable today? The more detailed you get, and the more specific you get to what about this case, what about that case, the more you're going to find a variance of opinions. And I will constantly say, you know, deal with that on a case-by-case basis, and ask, you know, somebody you trust to, like, deal with certain things like that. All right? Have a wonderful week.